Hello and welcome to Let the Stones Speak. My name is Christopher Eames. I'll be your host for today's program. I'm coming to you today from the location of the Tabernacle, or the replica of the Tabernacle, here in Timnah in southern Israel. We came here to interview Professor Erez Ben-Yosef of Tel Aviv University. He's the director of the Timnah Valley Project, and currently they're undergoing a several week-long excavation and survey here at Timnah. He's someone who we've interviewed in the past about this really important site, particularly from the 10th century time period, this very crucial time period of David and Solomon. The biblical account, of course, talks about this southern Edomite territory as having been subjugated by King David and on into the reign of King Solomon. And there is indication of the immense copper reserves in this area being used to help construct the temple with bronze that was without weight for the immense amount that there was used of that. So this was a key copper production facility here in Timnah throughout a huge span of time, a long period of time, particularly with a peak during the 10th century BCE. So we'll be talking to Professor Erez Ben-Yosef here. We hope you enjoy the program. If you like our content, be sure to subscribe and like this video. It helps us out. Professor Erez Ben-Yosef, it's great to see you on the site. King of Timnah. Last time we talked with you was in the office at Tel Aviv University. That was actually just before October 7th and those events.
Right.
But it's great to see you back in the field now. It's great to be here at Timnah on location with you. If you could start out for our viewers online just explaining where we are geographically. In modern Israel, in terms of ancient territory, where are we standing right now?
We are very close to the city of Eilat. It's the farthest tip of Israel to the south. It's very far. It's about 300 kilometers south of Jerusalem, in nowhere. There's nothing around us. It's a very harsh desert. It's a hyper-arid desert, no water sources around us, no vegetation, no agriculture. It's really a very harsh place to be in. And the reason people came here for thousands of years is the copper. So we are in Timnah Valley, about 20, 25 kilometers north of Eilat. It's a beautiful park. You can see all around us that geology is amazing. There's a lot of things to do and see. But the main story here is about the copper, the copper ore, and the story of the extraction of copper by people for thousands of years, as I said, but we now know there was a peak of production in the biblical times. And this is what we studied for the last several years, and this is what we do also this season.
Okay, could you give just a quick overview, quick if you can, of the development of ideas about this site, going back to Nelson Glick, or even before then, if there was some other ideas up till now?
The first we know about this place from a visit of John Petherick. He was the British consul in Khartoum, and he came to Aqaba, and the local guys knew he is a mining engineer, and they thought he would be interested in these ancient mines, ancient copper mines, and they took him here to Wadi Manaiya, showed him the piles of slag, the waste of furnaces. Back then, they didn't even know where the mines themselves are located. And since then, many explorers and scholars came through the place and described this amazing scenery, the landscape, and the piles of waste of copper production. The first to give them a date was Nelson Glick, the famous Jewish archaeologist, who came to the region in the 1930s, and using the pottery, he said it's all related to the Iron Age, to the early Iron Age, and maybe this is the source of wealth of the kings of Jerusalem, in particular King Solomon, and King Solomon's mines, maybe. King Solomon's mines. So this was kind of the discussion at the day, and then in 1959 there was the first systematic research project here by Benno Rothenberg, who established the Araba expedition, And they came here year after year to survey and to find new sites. And at the beginning, they accepted this Iron Age dating. But in 1969, there was a major discovery. That is maybe the most visited place in Timna. And this is the little temple that we have
That's
here.
That's right behind us.
Right behind us, below these sandstone cliffs. They saw a little structure below the boulders and thought about excavating it. They first saw it in 1964, but then 5 years later, they said, yeah, this is the time to excavate it. And they found thousands of artifacts of a place that is for sure a temple. And not just a temple, but an Egyptian temple from the time of the New Kingdom. We have their hieroglyph and cartouches telling us who were the pharaohs that came here from Egypt, or sent expeditions from Egypt to mine the copper, starting from Seti I to Ramesses V. So we're talking about 1300 all the way to about 1140 BCE, about 160 years of activity, controlled, at least controlled by the Egyptians. And because of this discovery, Rautenberg said, all of these major smelting sites should be dated to the time of the Egyptians. Back then, we're talking about 1969, then he excavated again in 1971. It was very popular to be very critical against the biblical texts. And he, had some arguments with Nelson Glick about that not being Solomon's Mines, and there is no connection to Jerusalem, it's not even the right period, and there is no pottery from Jerusalem here, until he convinced Nelson Glick and Albright in 1971, just before both of them died. They died in 1971, Albright as well, they died the same year, and they accepted his chronology, they accepted his reconstruction of an Egyptian industry, an Egyptian enterprise that lasted for 160 years. And the story about Solomon and the biblical period was really forgotten. And when I came here first in 2009, we thought we know everything there is to know about the place. A major Egyptian industry and a little bit here and there from other periods. As I said, there's thousands of years of history. The earliest sites are dating back to the Chalcolithic, to the 5th millennium BCE, and the latest sites are from the early Islamic period, let's say 7th and 8th centuries AD.
So that's got to be one of the longest operating copper mining places in the world, right?
One of the few mines that operated for so long. And more than that, and this is a very important point, it was not destroyed by modern activity. Because when we archaeologists go to seek other mines, and it's very interesting to many archaeologists all over the world, this technological change and how people were using the natural resources through the ages. In most places, it was destroyed by modern activity because we need copper today. It's still a very, very important material. And for example, the mines in Cyprus are mostly, the ancient mines are mostly ruined by modern activity. Here, at the early days of the State of Israel, there was a modern mine, but luckily it was mostly underground. Okay. So mostly in tunnels underground, and the archaeology is saved. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but it's also in a desert area. So it's accessible. You can go, go out of your car and touch remains that are thousands of years old.
Well, you were pointing out to me, we're just standing on top of an old petroglyph right here. So it's like
thousands of petroglyphs.
Around us.
Yeah. Hundreds of small sites of different periods telling us the story of copper extraction through the ages, and it's just here.
So you came along with the intent to find out that technological development.
Yes, having in mind Rautenberg's picture, he was still alive. I started my first excavation here in 2009, and he gave his blessings. He was. Just to say one more thing about his project, he was the first to realize how important Timna is for the reconstruction of ancient technologies, And that metallurgy, ancient metal production, is the most sophisticated, the most complex technology of ancient times. So if we want to learn something about the interaction between people and the natural environment, and also about technological evolution, how ancient people invented stuff, how they got some technological progress, this is the best place to learn all of that kind of things. And he established what we called the sub-discipline of archaeology, which is called archaeometallurgy, the study of ancient metals and metal production technologies and all of that. And I did my PhD in archaeometallurgy with Professor Tom Levy in San Diego, working with him in the mines in Jordan. And I was interested in technological questions, in this magic of how people took the green rocks, put them somewhere in a furnace, a very sophisticated one, and got this red metal that they can melt, they can mix with tin to get bronze. It's amazing. It's like a magic, the alchemy of the Middle Ages. It's like fantastic stuff. I was focused on the technology of the second, first millennia BCE. And I wanted to come here, or let's say it was one of the main reasons, to go to a site excavated by Rothenberg as a smelting camp of the Egyptian New Kingdom. And I went, got all the permissions and everything from Rothenberg, as I said, got the excavation license and started excavating. And all started here. You can see just below us in the wadi over there, you can see the smelting camp surrounded by a wall. This is called Site 30. And you see it was already excavated in 74 and 76. And when we got there, we found a place where it was not excavated before, and we also cleaned the sections that he created many years before us. And we started collecting data, and after we finished, we sent all the samples to be dated by radiocarbon to Oxford. We worked with Oxford, and when the dates came back, it was a big surprise. Nothing came from the Egyptian period. Nothing, not a single date, even from the bottommost, the lowest strata. Wow. Nothing. It started actually exactly after the Egyptians left, mm-hmm. in the late 12th century BCE, and continued all the way to the 9th century with a peak in the 10th century BCE. So we were very baffled, and we were not sure what to do, because this was published as a New Kingdom site with pottery, etc. But then I got into the details, and there was some confusion with the pottery. The radiocarbon was correct. It was clear that the main period of occupation, of activity, at least in this site, is not related to the Egyptians whatsoever, and we are back to Nelson Glick. Okay, so Nelson Glick was, after all, correct. Mm-hmm. And this was the main reason why we started our big project here, because of this chronological confusion, and we wanted to understand what's going on here, who was here, what is the story. So we came to Slaves Hill, the site we are standing on. This is Slaves Hill. It's one of the largest smelting sites in the valley that Rothenberg deliberately, he told me personally that he deliberately left it to the next, to the future generations. He was very generous and he was a visionary in that respect.
I.e. you.
So we are the next generation, yeah. And but we excavate very carefully and very little. Mm-hmm. We leave plenty for the future, generations to come. But you see, this site is much closer to the temple. Mm-hmm. So we were sure, okay, this is the story. Here, the Egyptians smelted copper. They were here for the copper. No, as we said, there is no other reason to be in this harsh place. And they came here and they had to smelt the copper somewhere. So we said, okay, this is very close to them. We excavate, we find the Egyptian story. And after the first season, all the dates came from the Iron Age and even from a narrower window. So we're talking about the very late 11th century and all the way to the second half of the 10th century. We believe this site was abandoned with the Shishak's campaign. Not because he destroyed the sites, but he triggered the technological change, reorganization of the industry, and made it much more centralized.
Right. And but those dates,
for anyone who knows the chronology, are incredibly significant because that's the very time block specifically of David and Solomon.
It's exactly the time of the
end
United
of the 11th to second half of the 10th, precisely.
So that's an amazing change in the archaeology of the region, of the south, of the deserts, of Edom. It started actually with the project, the American project in Jordan, that I did my PhD as part of this major project of Tom Levy. They've shown that the mines there that were considered to be an Assyrian imperial activity should also be dated yearly to the 10th century BC. Mm-hmm.
And we did this would be Fainan and some peripheral sites?
Mm-hmm. The big Fainan area. And so these projects together, now we not only that we know that people were here in the land of Edom at the time of King David, we also know that David had a very good reason to go to this very far place and conquer the Edomites and subjugate them to Jerusalem. There is no better reason at that time than this copper production activity. You really cannot exaggerate the importance of this industry at that time period. And it was not a small scale. It was not for local consumption. As the researchers and the teams that work in the Araba, it's very clear to us because we can see the amount of slag. It's the black material behind us. All of this
This is the slag.
This is the slag.
Us.
It's all the waste of furnaces. All of that is, you can calculate the amount that of copper that was produced here every year. We can do this calculation shortly if you want, but okay. We knew that it's a huge amount of copper. Nobody listened to us, but now we have more and more teams that study the copper itself, copper objects from Egypt, from the Arab, copper objects from Greece. A German team a few years ago published artifacts from Olympia and Delphi, 10th century, 9th century, from the Araba, copper objects from Lebanon, etc. I think every place in the Eastern Mediterranean and maybe even in the greater region, if you test the copper artifacts in this particular time, you will find that it is from the Araba. So for this a short window of time, or not so short, a few hundred years, the Araba became the major copper supplier of copper for a huge region.
Right, that's going well into the Mediterranean region.
Into the Mediterranean, into Greece.
From here, the middle of nowhere.
From here. And this is this is a game changer in our understanding of the period from many different perspectives. One of these perspectives is related to the economy of the people around the region, so the Edomites in particular, but everybody else around the trade routes. If you take copper from Timna and you want to go in Fainan and you want to go to Gaza, to trade on the Mediterranean, you have to go through the Be'er Sheva Valley. Who is controlling the Be'er Sheva Valley? Everybody that was on this trade routes could have benefited enormously from this very lucrative industry. Mm-hmm. And we won't be necessarily able to find evidence for that, because the metal is very precious. You can remelt it, you can recycle it, so it doesn't leave a lot of traces. The local peoples could have benefited enormously without leaving a direct trace of this usage of copper. So, as I said, this site was also dated to the 10th century and
the same time frame exactly as
this is about 100 years. This is about 200 years. Okay. This site was longer because after this site was abandoned, the other site continued to operate with a better technology. Actually, there was a major change in this transition, including the first introduction of domesticated camels to the region. And this site over there, which continues into the 9th century, we have the earliest camel bones in the entire Levant. So it makes sense, right? This is an industry in the desert, trading with the Mediterranean. If there was a new technology for transportation, they would be the first to use it in this region. Mm-hmm. It does make a lot of sense, and we also published this observation. But anyways, this is really a narrow window of 100 years, there are 200 years, but where are the Egyptians? So we continued, we excavated another site, site 15, nothing Egyptian. We excavated another site, Site 35. Site 35, it's all the wadi below us. It's full of slag and little structures. This site might begun in the latest phase of the Egyptians, in the early 12th century, but it is mostly 11th century. The only site in the entire region that we know that to have activity in the 13th century is site 2, the mushroom site, and it's cited is also open to visitors, okay. Like the temple. Mm-hmm. So there the signs are correct, because the signs were done in the days of Rothenburg, and it says it's an Egyptian smelting site, and this is correct. It's the only site where we have pig bones. Mm. And it makes sense, because in that period, only the Egyptians and the Philistines ate pig, and the local peoples, including the Edomites and the Moabites and the Ammonites, did not eat. Mm-hmm. Did not consume pig. So out of these 10 big smelting camps, only one is related to the Egyptian period per excellence, and all the others represent the period after the Egyptians left the place. And they did not leave because the copper ended, but just because, you know, they had troubles, big troubles back at home, this right. Bronze Age collapse. The Bronze Age collapse, and they had they didn't come here again almost ever. Shishak was, Shoshank the First did have some interest in the region, but he did not control the region. He came for a specific campaign made to make sure the copper gets to Egypt and all of that. This was the time of the locals after the Egyptians collapse. And not only the time of the local people, but the time of the tribal nomadic society in the region of Edom. Similar thing, I believe, is relevant. It happened in the hill country.
And this is getting into what I think you call the architectural bias.
Exactly.
So, yeah, maybe you could explain that to us. Because we don't see any big homes or dwellings or stone settlements here. But we do see evidence of people being here doing a lot of work.
And this is exactly the point, that we don't have any empires in the background. The Assyrians are not relevant to the region for a few hundred years, and the Egyptians just left. And we have only the local nomadic tribes. And what we excavate is not their dwellings, it's not their cities, it's not their villages. It's industrial sites that they came to these sites year after year after year. But they were nomads. It's clear that they were the dwelling where they lived was in tents all around us, and usually they came from probably places with more water and things like that. They came here with tents, and this is really this is a big challenge for the common assumption regarding nomads of this time, because the common assumption is that nomads in the early days of the biblical period were like the Bedouins of today. So they were not very powerful, they were a simple society, they could not be part of any kingdom. This is a research assumption, it's nowhere to be found in the Bible. On the contrary, the biblical story is all about the power of nomads, of tribes, the tribes of Israel, the tribes of Edom. But the assumption was that until everybody settled down, we cannot talk about anything serious, not a kingdom, not even something that is important for the history of the region. And this is because of many things. I wrote several papers about trying to understand the origin of this assumption. But one main reason is, of course, the ethnography of the modern Bedouins. So the modern Bedouins became the face of everything, and they indeed are simple society. All the stories about these tribes during the Ottoman Empire, it's all about them going against the centralized government of the Ottoman Empire, a dangerous place, if no law, you had to pay bakshish to go from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea, it was very dangerous. The tribes themselves always fought with each other. It was not something that you can consider to be a basis for any powerful kingdom or anything like that. And this ethnography, forced an interpretation of the nomad of the Bible period, of the biblical period. Really, it was the main reason why we always thought about the nomads of the biblical period as something that cannot be the basis of any kingdom. But it's not what the texts tell us. And when we read about the early kings of Edom, for example, they fit much better a nomadic kingdom than a settled one. But let's go back to the evidence here. As we just said, all of this amazing industry was, it was agreed, it was agreed by everyone that it belongs to an empire. Here, the Egyptians, Phoenicians, the Assyrians. So now we don't have any empire. I'm not saying that the Edomites were the Edomite Empire, but for sure the biblical author could see this coalition of tribes as some sort of a kingdom. Some sort of a kingdom. There is no other explanation. It cannot be, we cannot treat these people as, you know, some Edomite tribes doing some opportunistic copper production here and there. It was well organized, a very large scale. You needed stability for this trade to flourish. You really needed something stable, which is kind of an overarching organization that we can call the Edomite Kingdom. And this Edomite Kingdom was nomadic. So up until recently, nobody thought about the possibility of a nomadic kingdom, and now we have a direct evidence here for a nomadic kingdom. And what's important here is that without these Edomites working in the copper mines, we wouldn't know about them. Because, you know, nomads are almost invisible. And if we were to find some tent remains, we would say, okay, a few Bedouins were here. So we either would say there was a big gap, or we would say some Bedouins were here. But we would never be able to think about this kind of organization if the economy was not based on copper. Maybe the Arabian trade, which we know started already in this period, could have been a reason for the consolidation of tribes into some sort of an early kingdom. There could be many other reasons for the rise of these ancient kingdoms that is not the copper, and you won't see any pronounced archaeology to go with that. And I believe it's very, very relevant to the study of ancient Israel, because there is almost a consensus that the ancient Israelites came from a nomadic background. Both the Jerusalem scholars and the Tel Aviv scholars and many others would agree that the origin of these peoples is nomadic. So the main missing thing here is about the ability of nomads to create a kingdom or a polymorphous society, which is a mix of nomads and sedentary people, and you don't have to have all the population settle down and adopt urban attributes and urban way of life before we can talk about the kingdom.
So you get whispers of that in the biblical account as well, of like you said, a polymorphous type thing for the kingdom of Israel with structures in some places, but you do have illusions as well, like when Brent said in his last program, Jeroboam becomes king and says, "To your tents, O Israel."
Absolutely, that's a beautiful example. "To your tents, O Israel," is a very famous phrase that all scholars believed. It's figurative, because nobody lived in tents. It's impossible that people were still living in tents in this magnificent period of the United Monarchy. But this is a Western projection onto the period. If you read the text literally, they go back to their tents.
Right. And his saying that seems to make it sound like that is the rule rather than the exception. If they were mostly in structures, he would have said to your structures. Seems like they're mostly still at that point transitioning from tents.
I agree completely, and I think that even archaeology tells us that in the 10th century there is the majority of the populations was still living in tents. Why? Because if you count the number of people, that's what archaeologists love to do. And that's what Finkelstein, for example, did for the 10th century Judah. He counted 5,000 people, and then he went on to say 5,000 people cannot hold any significant kingdom. It's very, it's a very small group. We cannot talk about anything sophisticated. How does Finkelstein count the people in Judah? By what he sees, meaning that only the sedentary part of this population is visible to us archaeologically. So we can say and count the number of of people according to the built structures. Okay, if you go with this method to the early 8th century, you get in the area of Jerusalem about 40,000 people. If you go to the Shvela, it's even more amazing. From 1,500 people, you go to 50,000 or 100,000. It depends who you ask. You cannot explain this growth of population by natural growth of population. There is no model to explain that just by the natural growth of population. A lot of procreation cannot explain that. There is no way. So scholars were struggling with that. So some scholars suggested that more people came from the outside. Other scholars critiqued Finkelstein's observation, said he was wrong, but the answer is much simpler. Mm-hmm. They were always there. Mm-hmm. They just became more and more visible because of the transition into sedentism and right. into settlements. So they were. There is a lot of evidence that tell us that in the 10th century, the population was still kind of nomadic, and it was not a very rapid process. Mm-hmm. Like, people say, okay, early Iron One, we see these little villages, and this is all the entire population. If you do agree that the origin of the Israelites was nomadic, it doesn't make any sense that they became settled overnight.
Right,
it doesn't make any sense. It was probably the excitement of the archaeologists, the first archaeologists that were able to see them. So they wanted to stress that they can see the ancient Israelites. They were so excited. So they said that we can see all of them, and this is the picture, we can tell you what happened. But the real picture is probably that they saw a tiny fragment of the earliest families that settled down. It's like a small farmsteads, right. And it was very temporary. Many of these sites are very short-lived. So this is a much more realistic picture, that we see only a fragment of a much bigger picture. With the years, with the generations, we see more and more people settling down, but it took a long process. The Bible itself tells us that one big tribe, the sons of the Rechabites, continued to live in tents all the way until the end of the Iron One. So it says there clearly.
Yep.
So it's very clear that the earliest phase of the ancient Israelites was a mix of nomads and settled people, and they came with a nomadic culture, so it was not the first thing on their mind
right.
to build huge palaces and stone monuments. It was not their tradition. And people that are looking only for that, they are doing, it's kind of a bit misleading because they are using
a bit anachronistic.
It's not necessarily relevant to even the comparison with the Philistines, with their urban culture, and saying, here we have a big city like Gath with walls, and in the Judean country, in Judean hills, we don't have that. So that's how the poor, miserable people of Judah, and here it doesn't, it's like comparing apples and oranges. It doesn't make sense. And it's all coming from here, because here they came year after year, nomads, and you ask yourselves, they did get a lot of wealth. And some scholars
right, some
believe...
Right, some of the rich finds that you've discovered,
exactly.
Incredible wealth.
So this is another misconception, that as soon as the nomad will have some money to build a stone house, they will do it. It's just something that it's a projection of the Western way of thinking, that nomadism is something that you do only because you don't have the resource to build the house. And you live your miserable, poor life only because you just don't have enough money.
Right.
But it's not like that. Mm-hmm. A nomad has a tradition of being nomad. Even if they will get really wealthy, that will not be the first thing they will do. So how they manifested their power, how the local king, how the local ruler said that he is important, the Bible tells us as well. What, for example, huge amount of cattle and sheep and wealthy, like livestock and all of that, it's a status. It's,
right.
it's a symbol of status.
Even the king of Moab, the sheep master,
the
he's
sheep,
called.
Exactly. So you see, it's all there. It's the king himself.
Yeah.
More than that, and this is one of the most amazing discoveries of ours in recent years. What does the Bible say about the kings of Midian in the book of Judges? Gideon fought against the Midianites and he defeated them. And what does it take from the kings? Gold. Okay, there we find, we didn't find many gold here yet.
You don't expect to.
Maybe in the tombs. Yeah, exactly, of course. It is always reused, but maybe in the graves. But the spoil that he takes from the kings of Midian, by the way, kings, it fits much better for a tribal nomadic society than a settled society with a capital, is the garments, the purple garments. And here, a few years ago, we excavated some purple garments. We didn't know it's the real purple, but then Dr. Nama Sukenik ran the experiments and were able to show that this is the true purple made of cis nails, you know, the most expensive color in antiquity. Here, 300, more than 300 kilometers away from the place it was produced, physical evidence of three pieces of a garment for somebody very, very important. And this is not far from the area of Midian. Okay, so when we think about these kings, the Midianites as well, they at that period were not settled yet. And these important kings were showing their status with many other things, but not with stone buildings and monuments.
Right.
It's very, think about, you know, it's so important because in biblical scholarship, you know, a German biblical scholar in the 18th century who read about the kings of Midian would say, okay, where is the evidence? Let's see, where is the capital city? Where is the wall? Where is the... And they didn't find anything. So they said, this has to be anachronistic. This story is not true because archaeology shows us that there is no big cities, but actually there is nothing from that period in the entire region of Midian. And it's the same from Edom. There is no capital city, there is not even a village until the late 8th century. So the stories about Midian, the stories about David's conquest in the south, this is all anachronistic. It was all written many hundreds of years later, because only from the late 8th century we see a city, Bozra, with a wall. There is something very fundamental that we have to think about regarding our reconstruction of history out of the archaeology. And this is so fundamental because of this nomadic component of the story. Until now, we thought we know this component very well, which is kind of not important. Nothing is significant can happen as long as they are nomads. But now we have to rethink all of that. And the conclusion might be that archaeology cannot be as decisive as some scholars present it to be, and that we might not have the answer as easy as we think, as we thought we can have it, the answer we can
have. I like the way you put it. I think it was in your 2019 article that archaeology by itself will always trend toward minimalism, because you can only describe what you see,
and
you don't see these nomadic settlements.
Absolutely. If you are, especially if you are, consider yourself a very scientific, science-based archaeology, that you have to have direct positive evidence for everything you say. You can do some extrapolations, and it's okay. It sometimes makes much more sense to do extrapolations and to build a picture out of what we don't have as well. For example, now we do know that nomads in the south, the Edomites, created a kingdom, and there is very good reason to believe that the kingdom to the north, their neighboring kingdom, their brother, their brotherly kingdom, Jacob and Esau, were twins. So there is all reasons to believe that a similar process happened in the hill country. They did not mine huge shafts. We have 10,000 shafts here. It's very pronounced, I can tell you. Right, you know, it's very impressive. We have 1,000 tons of slag here. So the ancient Israelites did not engage in something so pronounced archaeologically. So we cannot study them in the same resolution as we can study the Edomites, but it's just a matter of luck, because they engage in copper production, which is one, maybe the only industry in ancient times that is so visible to us. All this industrial waste, all of these mines, it's something very impressive, and you know, that was also the reason why people thought it's only empires that can be behind that.
And that's why this kind of archaeology here is so key as well, because you can compare it directly to other sites like Fainan and compare how the technology develops, how it's being shared. And that's one of the big reasons that we know there was this broad control over this area, exactly, because you can see that progress.
You've done your homework, Chris.
You could say that a little bit.
This is our paper from 2019. And again, I started by saying that my expertise is actually the ancient technology of copper production or metal production in general. And we study in very fine details the technological evolution and changes through time. And what we see, as you said, is that the exact same transitions, the exact same changes happened at the same time here and in Fainan. And in this kind of a very sophisticated technology, and sometimes it's even a secret, like metallurgists kept their knowledge as a secret. It was something that you could trade with. And seeing these transitions, changes happening at the same time in both areas necessitates an overarching entity that coordinated all of this knowledge transfer and also the trade and all of that. And this is another aspect that tells us that we can talk about a kingdom here in this region, the ancient Edomites. There is an argument, not everybody accepts the Edomite identification, but we think, I'm talking also about the excavators of Fainan, Tom Levy, Muhammad Najjar, that there is very good reason to associate these people with the Edomites. Actually, saying otherwise very complicates the picture very much, and it's like trying to be over objective, and it creates many problems. We can talk about why these are the Edomites, but I think it's more and more accepted by many colleagues that these are indeed the early Edomites that later on settled in the Edomite plateau. Mm-hmm. And another confusing thing that people think about Edom as Southern Jordan, Petra, the Red Mountains and all of that. But this is again something that is a modern situation. And if you go back to the Bible, it's clear that the Arba and the Southern Negev of Israel were part of the Kingdom of Edom. When Solomon, right, David conquered the Edomites, and Solomon, his son, built the port in the city of Elat, in Etzion Gaber, in the land of Edom. It says that explicitly. So I think many tourists, if you would ask them where is Edom, they will say in Jordan. But right, the Bible itself says clearly, explicitly, that this is the land of Edom. And if it was subjugated to Jerusalem or not, people ask me, do you have a proof that this was part of the kingdom of Jerusalem? I say, I don't have any direct proof. I don't think I would ever find such proof, because what is this subjugation? It's enough that they had a contract that they paid tribute to Jerusalem, 500 ingots of metal every year. And for the biblical author, it's enough. It's more than enough to depict this situation of subjugation. So you have to remember that archaeology cannot be used to prove everything.
It can only go so far.
So there is a lot going on.
It seems like, to that end, do you have some kind of trending toward northern areas in terms of with some of the Argamon remains?
For example,
including
the Argamon is one example.
The food, the fish products that you found from the Mediterranean.
Everything. We see a very rich trade. By the way, also with the south, we have these Midianite vessels. Sometimes the Korea painted ware. Rothenberg already found them here and knew that they came all the way from the south. Sometimes there is a confusion. These are not Midianite mines. These are most of the pottery. 90% or more is local. That's the Edomite. There was a Midianite component here, and we published recently, a few months ago, a paper with Asaf and Sabina Kleiman. Probably you know the guys. A fantastic paper that tells us what was the role of these Midianites in this copper industry, and we think they were the ones to carry the knowledge in the early days, the metallurgical knowledge. They came with the knowledge first under this activity with the Egyptians, and then this toolkit, these unique vessels, were part of the cultic activity, about the rituals that that were associated with the copper smelting. For us, it's technology. I can explain to you the chemistry, the geology, and all of that. For ancient people, there had to be a divine force that helped them, and they had to do some rituals in order for the smelting process to be successful. So we think that this ceramic is part of this part of these rituals and cultic activity. So definitely trade with the south. But looking north, you said from the coast we have the argaman, the purple garments. We have fish.
Which is crazy because the Gulf of Aqaba is right next door.
Absolutely, but
They're bringing fish from.
Henri Lernau had Dr. Henri Lernau looked at the fish, and by the way, he looked at the fish from different periods here. So, for example, the Islamic period, as you said, they got all their fish.
Makes sense.
Yeah, but in this particular period, the Idumats probably didn't engage in fishing too much. Maybe it was already belonged to different entity. I don't know, but we have this. The entire assemblage is Mediterranean. Mediterranean Sea and freshwater rivers up in the north. And why? And I can go on and on. We have almonds. Almonds are not local, and they came from the hill country. You have almonds there. We have one of the very interesting discoveries was around the gatehouse to this site. We excavated something that we understood very early that it's dung, animal dung, donkey dung.
Okay.
So it was almost fresh. It was smelly a little bit. So we were sure some Bedouins were here 50 years ago. But it's organic. We dated it, and it's 3,000 years old. It's King Solomon's stables. If you want, they are here. We have stables of donkeys.
Like there's organic
actual
matter.
Dung of donkeys that were here, and also goat and sheep. They were kept next to the gate. They were not allowed to wander all around the furnaces to disturb the workers. They were parked in the entrance to the site. But what was more interesting is what we found inside of this dung. Inside of this dung, thousands of grape pips. Thousands. And it took us some time to understand what do we see, because it's too much to give these donkeys grapes. And it's not so, and even raisins. You give it to the people. So, after a while, I have good friends that live in the Shvela, in Moshav Agur, not far from Tel HaZeka, probably everybody knows Tel HaZeka, very close to Tel HaZeka, and they rented the place for the owner of a winery. And they told me, the owner of the winery gives all the leftovers of the wine production to his livestock. And I said, well, it's a reasonable explanation. And we looked into historical documents, and it was very, very popular practice to use this grape pomace, the leftovers of wineries, to feed livestock. Kulamela, a Roman historian, even tells us about two different processes. If you leave it a little bit wet, the animals work even better, and they are happy, and all of that. Of course, a little bit of alcohol. So you can see that this was a major activity of bringing from the hill country all the way here grape pomace to feed the donkeys that worked very hard by bringing water and supplies all the time from the nearby water spring, which is 15 kilometers away. It's a day walk. There was a lot of logistics, and a lot of finds point towards the north. People said, they could be in the Nabataean period and maybe earlier, they could grow grapes in the Negev. There are some evidence. But together with other experts, especially Dr. Daphna Langot, she was able to show pollen of wild flowers that grow only in the hill country. So we have very strong evidence for this massive trade. And I can go on and on. Right. There is a lot of different finds, and the uniqueness of this place is the organic material. You can continue your excavations in Jerusalem another 200 years in the Ophel, and you won't find the garments of anyone. That's just like this.
Right. And in this preservation,
the preservation
here is incredible.
And it's unique even in the desert. We have no such a place, even in Fainan. It's a bit to the north. There is a little bit more rain, every year, and there is nothing. You don't find any garments, anything like that. There are in Masada, in the Judean desert caves, there are some similarities, but from a later period, much later period, of course. And here, you know, there is not only the cloth, there is also the pieces of leather, of water sacks, and we have a belt, a fantastic belt of somebody from these days of King Solomon who lived here. Again, probably most of the people were the local Edomite. If there was somebody in a big tent coming from Jerusalem to supervise the work, I don't know. I don't think I will ever know. But the background for the biblical stories about the conquest of Edom, now we have the best background you could
wish
for.
We get a good illustration. Yes. Great background for it.
A great background, and it's quite amazing. It's very exciting, and we can take this observation, and especially the methodological observations, to continue the study of what's going on in the hill country.
And it's a great story as well of the progress from the time of Nelson Glick and the progress of research up to now, how
exactly.
The opinions changed.
You could see how you know, fragile the archaeological interpretations are.
Right, for sure.
Nelson Glick, King Solomon's Mines. Then Rothenberg, it's only a big empire. Mm. Then Ben Yosef, back to Solomon. this is important because before our project here, everybody accepted the imperial association. So now if some scholars try to say it's not so significant, it's a few Bedouins doing some copper here and there, it doesn't work. What was, I'm not saying we talk about the Edomite Empire, but for sure, the Edomite kingdom was here yearly. So that's the big picture. And now maybe I can say it to the guys at home that we opened a few months ago a new exhibition of the textiles themselves in the entrance to Timna. That's the place there. This is where they were discovered, and you can just visit and see even one of the fragments of the Argaman at the entrance to the park. And every time I see this, it amazes me.
And I should also say that we have some textiles from here at our exhibit
in
Edmond, Oklahoma.
Together.
So anyone who's in America, or you don't have to be in America, you can go visit. You can visit that.
I think you also have some pieces of slag and other
exactly.
things from the region
yep.
to show what slag is. And it looks like a stone and it seems boring, but for us
right.
it's a treasure of information. We do the chemistry and mineralogy, and we know the temperatures and the mixture of stuff they enter to the furnace, and it's a big story in itself. I think this will be your next visit.
Well, as we wrap up, maybe you can just say how this past season has gone, or if it's,
of course,
if you can.
No, that's there are two aspects for our work here this year. One of them is the continuation of excavations. You can see maybe
here.
So this is the only square we opened this year. We have a small team because of the war. But what we do is enough for our research purposes. What we have done in recent years, we created a chemical map of this entire site, and we were able to see where are the highest concentrations of several elements, and most importantly here is lead and copper. There were two reasons for it. One is to study the ancient pollution. There were scholars working in Jordan mostly that said that this pollution was really bad, and that people even today living in these regions suffer from this pollution. And I'm working here for more than 20 years, so I was really worried about myself and my team working in the mines and the slag and all of that. So I wanted to do a systematic research with my own team, with my own instruments and with my own chemical analysis. And we studied, there are 400 samples from here. We have fantastic results that show clearly that the only dangerous place is just next to the furnace. And that most of the people working here did not suffer at all. By the highest standards of the of the American Agency for Environmental Protections. The numbers are, you need to have more than 1,200 parts per million of lead in order for the place to be unsafe for workers. And if you raise children, it's 200 ppm and more. And here we have, you know, tens of ppms. Mm. And in the furnace area, maybe a little bit more than 200. Yeah. So this is one aspect, and we published it a few months ago, and it was big in the media. People can search it, and you can see that King Solomon did not pollute the area, the environment. He was green. He was a green king. He cared for the environment.
You have this max output that you found, but yet not affecting the environment.
Not the entire population that lived here in tents. The guy working at the furnace, who was probably part of the elite. There's another discussion. There were no slaves on this hill. This was the
despite high society. It being called Slaves Hill. This is another misconception.
Yeah. This is where Nelson Glick was wrong. He was correct about the chronology, but his perception was too romantic, and he thought only slaves can work in these harsh conditions. But slaves could work in the mines, and probably did work in the mines. But here, the smelting, the most sophisticated technology, as we said, is something for very, very skilled craftsmen. It's something that, it's a magic, it's a secret, it's, you know, anyone that knows about something about metallurgy will understand that. And we see it in the material culture. The purple garment is from here. So they were associated with the elite, with the rulers and all of that kind of stuff. But this guy that was working at the furnace did suffer from pollution. He didn't probably live longer. We know that lead especially, and there is lead here in association with the copper. Lead is the more dangerous element. We have here lead, and we know that it's very poisonous, and probably the guy specifically working in the furnace suffered from pollution. But the rest of the population back then and today are safe.
So it's, you're okay.
I'm okay, according to my observation. But the other reason to do for the survey is that we thought that maybe that was our hypothesis, that where the concentration of copper and lead is the highest, that's where we can find the furnace bottom, which is very rare. The problem with reconstruction, the technology, is that every time they smelted copper, they broke the furnace, because the copper sunk to the bottom and they had to extract it. Mm. So we never find intact furnaces. And then we just find fragments, and it's very hard to say exactly what was the shape. And if we are lucky, we can find the bottom of the furnace. And we thought, we went with this map of element chemical concentrations, and that part of the square we found in the exactly where the highest concentrations of lead copper were, we found intact furnace remains. It was in the last day of last season, so now we came back to expose this furnace, the bottom of the furnace. So this is the reason for this excavation here. The other thing we do, starting a few years ago, is a big survey of the valley. Again, when I started working here, we thought we know everything there is to know about the valley. That this was an Egyptian industry, an Egyptian copper production site, and that Rothenberg documented all the archaeological sites in the valley, and nobody was excavating here. There was no, so probably we thought there was no reason to excavate. But then every time we started a project of documenting all of Rothenberg's sites with modern instruments, the drone, the digital photos and everything, and every time we went to one of his sites, we found more sites. We understood that something is, there is more to discover. And when we went back to his papers, we didn't read them carefully, because he said specifically that he surveyed intensely only like a 2 by 2 kilometers area next to these cliffs over there. So he never claimed to survey the entire valley. So this is what we do this year. We have several teams walking around, documenting Rothenberg sites, correcting some of the mistakes that we have in the literature with coordinates and things like that. We use differential GPS. He didn't have any GPS, everything. So we correct his information, we add new data, and we find more and more sites. We found until now about 100 plus new sites, including some important ones with a lot of slag, like more to the calculations of how much copper was produced here. We can add now more and more with some everywhere. When you have more than a few hours, we can go for a walk, and I will show you new sites that were not known before. Mm-hmm. You know, in Israel, to find new sites, it's almost impossible. So intense archaeology. But again, because we thought Rothenberg found everything and walked in every wadi, nobody really did anything new here. And now we do it systematically, and eventually we will map the entire region, and we'll have all the sites and have the big picture.
It's so amazing
survey
work.
And excavation.
And so you've got 2 more weeks, I think, of this. So all the best to you. Thank you so much, Erez.
Thank you
always
for coming.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, yes, for me too.
Bahatzlacha.
Toda rabah.